afternoon, and welcome back from the week's break for Erev Shavuot. I trust that everybody had a Yom Tov full of learning, whether that was nighttime learning or daytime learning. Nighttime learning for we'll say really devoted. Daytime learning for the sane and rational.
I love what you sent out with the warning thing about learning at night. I sent it to a lot of people. It made me feel very good. I really love it.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Okay. Thank you very much. Okay. And there's an advertisement for the weekly email of the Beit Midrash. There you go. So, we are in Ezra Perek Tes, Ezra chapter 9. I think we decided that the year ends on June 20th. I think that's what we ended up with. Sorry? No. June 20. So what that means, though, because after that, certain people have to go to their cottages. So what I would like to do, though, is get through Ezra. Right? At least 50% of the commitment should be completed. So there are more chapters in Nehemiah, but a lot of it is old hat by the time you finished Ezra. So really, though, we have ground to cover. You know what? I do have a spare sheet still.
I have one too.
There you go. And there's one here. Okay. So if anyone needs more, we have a couple floating around. I will also note that I left flyers there for the Beit Midrash dinner, which I assume you've all heard about by now. But once again, it's our annual fundraiser, and it makes all of the different classes that we do, Arusa's Toronto Torah, weekly emails, and so on, possible. So, enough for that. Chapter 9, we began on this 2 weeks ago, and before Shavuot, with the topic of intermarriage. And what we said when we're talking about intermarriage is Jews marrying the nations who are around them. We already noticed, because we read the parallel passage in Malachi, that there's some dispute as to whether we're talking about marriage between the Jews and their non-Jewish neighbors in Babel, in Babylon, or whether we're talking about marriage with the non-Jewish neighbors in Israel, and whether this may be referring even to the Samaritans. We are going to see that the language of the text makes it sound a lot more like the latter, that we're talking about marriages entered into after they come back into the land. We already noted that would explain why Ezra reacts with such shock. Like, he's never heard of this. You know, if these were marriages that were going on in Babylon, they wouldn't have been news to him. He would have, you know, someone would have protested then, even if he's not personally hanging out with people who are doing this. Nonetheless, he would have heard about it the same way he heard about it now. So it really does seem more strong to take the view of the Medrash in Bereishis Rabbah, which says that these are marriages to women who are in the land. And as I said, we'll see in the Pesukim, in the verses themselves, it sounds that way. But what I want to start with is a question which, in certain circles, would be like, what are you talking about? Why is this even a conversation? But I think it is important to understand, particularly because most people aren't aware of the background on it, and that is the question of, what's wrong with intermarriage? So you hear already. You hear the reaction and the surprise, but really, when you get down to the question from the Jewish law perspective, if a Jewish man or a Jewish woman says, I have this great non-Jewish neighbor, she is wonderful, ethical, they're going to allow me to keep all of my mitzvot, they won't go into the kitchen, or they're going to honor my practices, whatever system you want to create for this. I'm going to still go to shul, you know, and even going with something we have to get to, which is the issue of matrilineal descent. So, you know, let's say it's a Jewish woman and it's a non-Jewish man, and she says, and he's fully willing to raise the kid as a Jew. He has no problem. He just personally himself does not want to accept Judaism. He doesn't believe in it. He doesn't want to be dishonest and pretend that he does for the sake of conversion. So he's going to be who he's going to be, but he's not going to keep me from doing it. Have you broken any rules? So clearly we think so. Because Ezra has to think so, because otherwise his reaction doesn't make any sense. No, no. I only gave the one case of the Jewish woman because of the matrilineal descent for the child. That's all. So, you know, clearly it's problematic in terms of the values of Judaism, in the sense that if it's a Jewish man who's marrying a non-Jewish woman and you take matrilineal descent, that means that he's not going to produce Jewish children. And that's a very, very important point for us. The idea of producing the next generation is critical. So you could say he's not living up to his requirement in that regard. You could say that it's going to be very hard to keep a proper Jewish home, even if it's the other way around, and it's a Jewish woman with Jewish children, because the kid at the end of the day is going to know that daddy's not into all of this. And as a matter of fact, daddy isn't Jewish altogether. That's going to, you know, that will create certain problems. But can you point to a biblical verse that says this is off limits, Jean?
No, I said the opposite. If you think about it, spoils of war, if a man sees a woman,
So Eisha Yifat Torah involves conversion. That's the way it's understood when it says she cries for her mother and father and so on, that is actually conversion involved.
But conversion as a result of wanting to get married, not marrying a convert.
So it would appear.
Not someone who converted out of ideological.
Correct.
But it's allowed this.
No.
Well, Eisha Yifat Torah, the case of the prisoner of war, without going too far afield, is strongly discouraged. What is done is to effectively discourage what often happens on the battlefield by imposing a 30-day waiting period on him. And then saying, if you're still interested after 30 days, you know, go ahead and live together.
So it's going to be a Vensor of all right.
That's another issue with the beginning of Parshas Ki Tetzé. Yes, Elisha.
So you're not allowed to do this in Torah, but isn't there something about that if you're from a certain Shevet, you should not marry somebody from another Shevet, because each Shevet has their own parcel of land and get things complicated if you don't. So isn't there somehow that prohibition?
So we're actually good with that. We're good with intertribal marriage. There is the issue that comes up in the wake of the Daughters of Tzlachot. Once people realize that in the event that there's no son, the daughter is going to marry whatever the family, the daughter's going to inherit whatever the family's land is. And if she's from Menashe and she marries somebody from Yehuda, then you're going to have a chunk of Menashe land in the middle of the broader Menashe territory that's going to have a little postage stamp, is going to have Yehuda on it, and it's going to create chaos. So there was concern in that generation of whether they'd be allowed to marry other men from other shvatim, from other tribes. But as a general principle, we're good with the idea of them marrying outside of their tribes. So we're not. What I need to set out the parameters for this conversation. First of all, we're not discussing anything before Sinai. Meaning, to say to me that Moshe marries the daughter of Yitro, I don't care. Because at that stage there is no covenant. There is no issue of who is a Jew, so to speak, and an inherited brit entered into. There may be certain mitzvot that are practiced before the Torah is given. So, you know, Abraham does brit milah, and we are told that that's a mitzvah now for all males down the line. But there's no sense of this person is now a Jew because they were born from Jewish parents. We do have a...
I whispered to Gita that not Solomon's wife...
Solomon's wives we do have to deal with, because they're post-Sinai.
Right.
So they do have to be part of the conversation.
Yes.
You can throw in Shimshon's wives also.
Yes.
But what we do have... Yeah?
Were the wives Canaanites, or were they...
Which wives?
These intermarried wives.
Good question. Good question. We have to come back to it. It's a very good question. Hold the thought. We do have a very clear message, going back to Bereishit, against marrying those who represent idolatry. Esav's wives are described as being a source of bitterness for Yitzchak and Rivka. Abraham does not want Yitzchak to marry a Canaanite, right? He gives very strict instructions. Lo sikachi shalav nimi bnos ha-Kanani. Do not take Canaanite women for Yitzchak. Rivka doesn't want Yaakov to marry a Canaanite either, although that's also part of her plan to get him safely away from Esau. But she echoes this idea that the Benot Haaretz, the women of the land, are no good. So we have a sense of values in terms of who you pick, but that's not a matter of ethnicity. It's not a matter of are they Jewish or non-Jewish. However, after Matan Torah, after the giving of the Torah, when there is a covenant that is passed down across generations, you do find a very strong statement in the Chumash, it's in Sefer Bamidbar, against this sort of thing, against intermarriage. What's the story that I'm talking about? Yeah, Zimri and Cosby, there you go. Right? After the incident with Moab, right? After the incident in which Bilam tries to curse the Jews, you then have a situation in which the daughters of the women of Midian and Moab come out to seduce the Jews, and a fellow by the name of Zimri becomes involved very publicly and visibly with Cosby, who is from Midian, and Pinchas kills them and is praised for doing so. Now, it was not a marriage situation, but why would that make any difference? In other words, that already tells you that there is something wrong here. There is a problem here. Could you say that it doesn't mean that intermarriage is always prohibited, but what was being done then and the way it was being done was the problem, and therefore his intervention was not a function of a law against intermarriage, but it was a function of a rebellion against Moshe that's really going on at that point, and a drawing near towards the Moabite idolatry? Maybe. Maybe. But I think you have to consider that case and ask yourself, is that precedent? Does that demonstrate anything? In terms of the marriages of foreign wives, Shimshon with the Philistine women, Shlomo with the women from various nations, none of whom are Canaanites, that's a side note. So there, when the sages look at it, they assume that this was a case of conversion. There's more to discuss in Shimshon's case regarding this, but the general assumption is that in both cases, there was some type of conversion involved, whether it's what we would call an ideal conversion, or I'm going to get to marry the king of Israel and cement peace between my nation and these Hebrews is another story. But it is assumed that these are conversions on some level. But noting that we're eliminating everything from before the Torah is given, just counting from then on, the only verse that we can find biblically that states anything resembling a clear prohibition is the one that I note for you on your sheets in source number one, and that is from Dvarim, Deuteronomy chapter 7. If you are using the Stone Tanakh, take a look, please, on page 445. Okay, the beginning of chapter 7. Ki yivyecha Hashem alokecha la'aretz asher atav Hashem alirishta. Hashem is going to bring you into this land, the land that you are supposed to take. V'nashal goyim rabim mipanecha. He is going to cast down many nations before you. Chiti, Girgashi, Amori, Knani, Brizi, Chivi, Yevusi. Everyone have it? Okay. Shiva goyim rabim v'atzuma mimekka. These seven nations who are greater and mightier than you are. Unsanam Hashem alokecha lefanecha v'hikisam. Hashem is going to put them before you. And you are going to strike them. Hacharim tachrimo. Sam lo sichros lem bris v'lo sichanim. No covenants, no deals. Separate discussion about ethnic cleansing another time. Not that it's a fun discussion to have, but right now we have one elephant we're dealing with. We don't really need two. But that's the state of war that you're in with these nations, and then you get Pasuk Gimel, sentence 3. Velosis chatein bam. You shall not marry among them. Do not give your daughter to his son. And do not take his daughter for your son. So marriage with them, both Jewish male with non-Jewish female and Jewish female with non-Jewish male, is prohibited. Pasuk Dalet, sentence 4, concludes this point. Ki asiras bin chame acharai, because he's going to lead your son away from me, God. Ve'avdu Elohim acherim, they will worship other gods. Ve'charav Hashem b'chem v'shmidcha ma'er, God is going to be very angry, and he will destroy you quickly. So, that is the source for a prohibition against Jews marrying non-Jews. But go ahead and tell me why this is not a good source. You know why. Yeah.
First of all, it's just talking about those seven nations.
Yeah. It's talking about the seven nations. It didn't mention anybody else. It did not mention the Egyptians. Mind you, they have their own verse elsewhere in Deuteronomy, right? About not marrying them until the third generation. So Egyptians can convert to Judaism and marry other Egyptians who convert to Judaism, and then three generations later, they can marry in among everybody else. So Egyptians we didn't necessarily need to mention because they're going to get their own verse. But we know all sorts of nations who don't make it in here. And when you look at the verse in context, you're coming into this land, you are in a state of war with these nations. It really sounds like it might be specific to those populations. Francis?
Well, because sorry. Consider 70 as a symbol of totality. Could that be inferred that 70 was, well, not just the nations, but the totality?
So it's an interesting argument that 7 would be the totality, except that it enumerates them by name. Right? Once you say, here are their names, I think you are locked into, you know, this particular group. If I accept that as a stipulation at all, the 7, then I have to accept the names that come along with it as the specification. Go ahead.
It seems to me that this is dealing with a strategy of war.
Yeah.
It's no different than the Midianite description earlier. It's the same thing. It's the strategy of the enemy to destroy the nation, if not through war, through intermarriage, mm-hmm. so to speak, to make it. And of course, Yaakov had the same issue here, you know, with Dina.
Right.
It seems to be something that goes through us that we see the enemy as either trying to destroy us through love or through hate.
Okay. So, but still, within that, I would argue that it's the nations you're at war with. It's the seven. It's not anybody else.
Yes.
You know, and maybe it should be Amalek, but they're not listed. Yeah, Janine.
Once it gives a reason, is one allowed to use that reason to apply it to, you know, halakhically to apply it to another nation that would cause the same problem?
Excellent. You are on the segue ball today. This is a perfect segue because if it's really a prohibition against marrying these seven nations, why did I need sentence 4? Sentence 4 says, because if you do, he's going to lead your son astray. Notice that it says son. That's something we're going to come back to, not this week, but when we discuss matrilineal descent. That's a
children.
Key line.
JPS says children, not son.
Because they don't like it.
Child. Of course not.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Our scroll says child. Okay. We'll deal with it when we have to. We have a phrase. Dialitzara b'shaita, right? Enough with the problem. With the problem I have right now, the next problem. But the fact that you add a sentence that says because it's going to lead your kid into idolatry opens up the possibility of saying it's not a prohibition against marrying the Canaanites per se. They're just the illustration at hand. But it's really against anybody who could lead your child into idolatry. Now you'll say, well, that's good then, because my non-Jewish neighbor is an atheist. He's not going to lead my child into, he's not going to lead me into idolatry. But keep in mind that, you know, Judaism doesn't like atheism either. We don't feel better. I mean, you could even argue in certain contexts that you feel worse about a situation in which someone doesn't believe altogether. So. Sorry?
We're not comfortable with other forms of monotheism either.
Correct.
No, I was going to say the same thing. Like, it's your Muslim neighbor. I'm like, you know, they're pretty sharp.
Yeah, stark isn't the problem.
Politically, yes, it's problematic, but halakhically.
I mean, no, because what they teach at the end of the day is contra Torah. It may not be, you may not fit it under the narrow label of worshiper of stars and constellations. Nonetheless, it ain't Judaism. You know, there are other boxes that are not being checked. So the question is, how do you read this? So take a look at source number 2, which is where this debate is brought in the Talmud, and indeed, we see two views. The Gemara says, "Benose hen de'oraisahi." This is following a passage in the Talmud in which they listed certain decrees of the rabbis, lest you mingle with the nations. And one of the decrees, one of the items listed, is their daughters. And the Talmud expresses surprise. What do you mean there's a decree against their daughters? It sounds like a decree against marrying their daughters. That's a biblical prohibition. Because the Torah says you shall not marry among them. We just read it. To which the first view brought here in the Talmud says no. De'oraisa sheva umos. The biblical prohibition. That's only for these seven Canaanite nations. Avosharav de kochavim lo. Doesn't apply to other idolaters. The Asuin, who along came the rabbis, the Gazara Filu Dishar of the Kochavim, and the rabbis extended the prohibition and said there is a decree against marrying anyone from other nations as well. To which the Gemara then says, Ula Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, what about within the view of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai? Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai is known in the Gemara as having a view which says that you can be Doresh Tama Dikra. Doresh Tama Dikra means that when the Torah says to you, do this or don't do that, it is legitimate to analyze what the logic behind the mitzvah is, and even to use it to influence the contours of the mitzvah. That's Rabbi Shimon's view. Generally speaking, not followed, but that's Rabbi Shimon's view. So Rabbi Shimon is going to argue here, I didn't need sentence four. Because I would have already known from sentence 3, where he says, don't marry them. Obviously, the concern is that they're going to influence you to idolatry. That would have been my natural deduction. So what is sentence 4, therefore? So the Gemara continues. Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai's view is that the verse that says he's going to lead your children or your son, whatever it is, away from me, that includes all who cause straying, meaning any nation. In other words, Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai's view, which is going to be the halacha here in the Shulchan Aruch, but Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai's view is that the biblical prohibition is against marrying anyone from the nations. Then what was the rabbinic decree? So the answer the Gemara concludes with is, at least at this stage, there's more discussion in the Gemara, is that maybe the biblical prohibition is to do it in the manner of marriage. They're going to live together with a formal agreement, they stay in the same house, and so on, whereas the rabbinic prohibition is to do so in a promiscuous way. That perhaps is the distinction that he would draw. But what you see here, without going into the whole Doresh Tama Dikra discussion, it's not as germane for our piece, is that there are actually two views in the Talmud. One view is that it is biblically prohibited, in which case I understand what Ezra was doing. Right? They came to him and said, Ezra, the nation's breaking the law. They're all marrying Canaanites. Well, they're not Canaanites. I'm sorry, I should note that. These are not Canaanites. Even if they are Samaritans, they're not Canaanites, because the Canaanite nations are long gone, right? That was the whole import-export deal, where the Assyrians got rid of the residents of the land as part of their conquest, and they brought in nations from elsewhere. We listed them when we talked about the origins of the Samaritans back in chapter 4. So these are not Canaanites. So they come to Ezra and they say, they're marrying people from who knows where. And Ezra is horrified because he says, we have a biblical law on the books. You can't do that. So if I take the view that it's a biblical prohibition, then I understand Ezra's take. So basically, I think I flipped it in reporting it here. Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai is the one who says it's biblical. If I take the view that it's biblical, then I understand why Ezra was so horrified. But if I take the view that it's rabbinic, then why was Ezra so shocked? Sorry?
Came later, unless it's Torah Baal Peh?
No, then it will be biblical. Even that which is not found in explicit verse, but we have by tradition going way back, has biblical status. Unless you have a situation in which a rabbi got up and made a decree, a rabbi from any era, but a rabbi got up and made a decree and said, this is a protection for whatever reason, that will make it rabbinic. So the other school of thought here will have to say that Ezra is the originator of the rabbinic decree. That Ezra is the one. Don't think rabbinic. People think rabbinic and they assume that that means, contemporary rabbi. That's not what we mean. What we mean is human being who is licensed with the authority by virtue of smicha, by virtue of ordination, to be able to create rules like this. So Ezra has the ability to make rules like that, and that will be the view. So we have two fundamentally different views. We have the view of Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai, this is biblical and Ezra is just a policeman. And then we have the other view that says, no, biblically they were not prohibited from marrying the Samaritans, or Babylonians, if you want to take the view that these were marriages from Babylon. And then Ezra came along, and for reasons we're going to have to discuss, created a rabbinic decree. You follow? Those are your two possibilities. But that leads us to an important question. If it is rabbinic, if Ezra is the one who invents this, how in the world could he do that? I mean, this is not like, you know, I don't want you to move those items on Shabbat because, you know, this is a pencil and it could lead you to go right. This is breaking apart families, as we're going to see. He's going to, the nation is going to do this in compliance with his shock. We'll see the wording. It's very interesting in the chapter in terms of how they go about doing it. But this is an awfully big decree for somebody to make. Not only that, go back to Ezra, please. Chapter 9. Let's go back again, because... Well, they didn't have to listen to him. You'll see when we get there. He represents him. Well, I don't want to jump to the end of the chapter before we've seen everything else, but Ezra is not going to force anyone to do anything. You'll see.
He does have the authority.
He has the authority, and he will not use it. You'll see.
Can I just ask?
This is who Ezra is.
How many years elapsed from the first Aliyah till Ezra came?
So we think it's a couple of decades, but it's hard to say. It's hard to say precisely. Correct. So take a look again in Ezra chapter 9. First of all, I call your attention to verse 1. If you're using the stone Tanakh, you're talking about page 1833. Ezra reports that after having given the instructions that he brought from headquarters to the officers in the land, then people come to Ezra and say, you know, these Jews are marrying the nations around them. In sentence 2, they married their daughters. Their daughters are mingling with Zerah Kodesh, with these sacred Jews. Chapter 9, sentence 2, sorry. So we have to talk about the officers. I'm not there yet. It's a very good question, but I'm so not there yet. But here's the question. If Ezra was the one who invented this, that means that up until Ezra's going to do something, which hasn't happened yet, there's no prohibition against these marriages. So why did they come report him? Why did they come to Ezra and say, you know, these Jews are marrying the nations around them? Not only that, take a look at chapter 9, sentence 10. Next page. Ezra declares, as part of his reaction, he declares to God, Mano mar elokeinu after Ezos. What are we going to say, O God, after this? Ki azavnu mitzvosecha. We have abandoned your mitzvot. Asher tzivisa biyad avadecha nevi'im. You instructed through your prophets, saying, you're coming into this land, and so on and so forth. There's corruption here from the nations of the land. We didn't do anything wrong.
Well, if we go back to the woman captured in war. So that is, it's permitted, but it's still not looked at favorably. So could you say that, okay, this, it is taboo to marry someone from these seven nations. So even though it's not explicitly forbidden to marry someone from outside of those, is it still not considered okay
right
at the time?
Right. So I think that is one of two possible answers here, at least two that I can come up with. The first answer, let me just go through this one. The first answer that I would give is that this is not a particular mitzvah, it's what we call a meta mitzvah. In the same way, there's a lot of controversy about the fact that when the Rambam gives his list of the 613 mitzvot, he doesn't count a mitzvah of settling the land of Israel. It's not there in the 613, which is, you know, strange, given the way that it pervades so much of the Torah, given the way that we have all these mitzvot of being in the land, given the fact that we even have a verse that says you're supposed to take this land and pass it on to your children, you're supposed to settle there, the other codifiers of the 613 did include it. Why didn't Maimonides include it? So there are a whole range of answers. Surprise. When the Rambam coughed, there were a range of explanations for why. But one of the prominent answers is that it's because the Rambam views this as an overarching meta-mitzvah. It's not one thing. It permeates so much of the Torah. So you could argue here the continuity of the Jewish people is a meta-mitzvah. It's not like you can point to a particular law, but Ezra knows, and the people know in general, that even if it's allowed, it's a very, you know, in the sense that I can't point to a verse against it, I can't point to a verse that says, don't live in Toronto. Nonetheless, it's clearly not what the Torah wants for you. God chose not to make it into a biblical sin, but it's going to raise the future of the Jewish people. It's going to change the future of the Jewish people in very real ways. That would be one way to look at it. The other way that you could look at it is to say, Jean, you were going to say?
I think it says Ketov is Potei and Lachani, that their behavior as a result was that they mimicked.
Yes. So I think that's the second possibility, is that it's because of concern for idolatry. Because the verses do talk about them not only marrying the nations, but following Ta'avot, which is a word that's often used in the Torah for idolatry. We're following the non-Jews into their Avodah Zarah, into their idolatry, and maybe that's what motivates this position by Ezra. In terms of practical law, just because you can't discuss this topic without noting, you know, where this goes in halacha, so the Rambam writes, Maimonides writes in source number 3, that it is a biblical prohibition. I brought this here for you on the sheet, but I'm not going to go through it inside. I just wanted you to have it accessible so you could see the text itself. Rambam follows the view here of Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai, in which he says that marrying them is biblically prohibited. And the Rambam actually in this, actually I should note it, in the text of the Rambam, quotes Ezra as one of his sources. He says, see, Ezra did it. Why do you need to quote Ezra when he has a verse already in Deuteronomy? Deuteronomy trumps Ezra. So why does he need to mention Ezra at all? So the commentators here, a work called Hameir La'aretz, Radbaz as well, explain that it's because I noted earlier that usually we don't follow Rabbi Shimon with his approach of analyzing the meaning of the text and so on. We don't usually follow Rabbi Shimon. So therefore, the Rambam needs to justify why he's taking Rabbi Shimon's view here, and the justification is it's consistent with Ezra. Yes?
In the English, it's an unusual phrase, and we use the word marriage and mates.
Yes.
Separately. So
that's me. I wrote that. Yes, okay. Because the Rambam follows the view that we expressed in source number 2, which is that the biblical prohibition is only in the manner of marriage. If it's a promiscuous thing, it's rabbinically prohibited. So you look perplexed.
Yeah, I don't see that if a Jew mates with an idolater from another nation in the manner of marriage.
Right, or a Jewess mates with an idolater in the manner of marriage, the Torah dictates lashes for them. That's the biblical prohibition. It applies,
applies for mating as well as marriage.
No, mating in the manner of marriage.
What does that mean?
It means that you set up a long-term relationship. It's not just a one-night stand. Yeah. If you have particular questions about particular relationships, we can discuss after.
But they are only talking about idolaters, and if somebody is not considered an idolater but a monotheist,
so right,
that's not being addressed here at all.
Any belief system outside of Judaism will qualify for this.
Even if they're not
idolatrous, even if they're atheists, even if they're Muslim, it doesn't make a difference. Yeah, you know, you have to remember, you know, this goes, I gave a class years ago in my school in Pennsylvania. Actually, it was a UJA program called Encouraging Intra-Marriage. It was about encouraging Jews to marry Jews, because I was very frustrated with the tendency that exists for people to do their fighting against intermarriage by thwarting their children. You know, if you marry someone who isn't Jewish, you know, I'm going to whatever. You know, it's a betrayal of the Holocaust. It's whatever it is. And the point of my session was to say that when children see that their parents live a joyous Judaism, that they benefit from it, that it's a rich experience, then they'll want to emulate it. In the event that you don't provide them with a model they'd want to emulate, warning them, you know, if you do this, isn't constructive. And there's more to be said, and I wasn't claiming that anyone controls what their children do. At the end of the day, there are a billion reasons why people do what they do. And contrary to Freud and others, a lot of it doesn't go back to the parents. The best proof of that, of course, in the Torah itself is Yaakov and Esav, who are twins, and they have the same parents, and yet go off in radically different directions. That was my pitch, was basically to create a home which encourages intramarriage. And at the end of the session, there are like 2 minutes left in the session, and a woman very respectfully raises her hand and says, "That was a great session, Rabbi. Now I'd like to give the other side." I didn't know there was an other side. It wasn't on the agenda, but, you know, she asked. I said, okay. And she described her personal situation, in which she was a Catholic who married a Jew, and they have children, and they want to send their kids to a day school, and she is committed to raising the children as Jewish, but she doesn't feel like she wants to convert. She feels it would be dishonest for her to convert. So this was her pitch, and I'm left with now the opportunity to respond, and I'm thinking, what in the world am I going to say? A bolt of lightning, thank you God, comes down, and I ask her, so would you say that your experience reflects the majority of such cases? Do you think that is normally the way it works out, where the husband gets to continue to practice Judaism, the kids are going to be raised as Jews? Leave aside that they were her kids, and I believe in matrilineal descent. That wasn't the point. But do you believe that that's what happens in the majority of cases? She had to acknowledge no. Parenthetically, since then, her family and I have become great friends, and yeah, there's more to the story. I'm not discussing that because, in case anyone ever watches or hears this and knows who I'm talking about, there were a lot of people at that class. I'd rather not go into it. But the point that I am making is that realistically, this goes back to Susan's point, the issue is not only will they be led into idolatry, but are you going to create a Jewish home? You know, this isn't about racism. I can't stand people who don't have the same grandparents I do. This isn't about, you know, we're better than them. I say it because of the Joe Lieberman interview.
Oh.
Remember that story? When Joe Lieberman was running for vice president on the Gore ticket, so Larry King had him on his talk show, and he stumped him. Larry said to him, how can you be the vice president for the entire United States when you wouldn't let your daughters marry a non-Jewish man?
How does he know that?
Right, so it was actually done as a question and answer, like, would you let, you know, which is no better.
Yeah, you can't let it do anything. Or not.
Yeah, that's whatever. And that's another story as well. But the point is that the issue is not we're better than they are. The issue is that fundamentally your kid is going to marry somebody who is not, you know, who is not Jewish, however wonderful they are as human beings. At the end of the day, if they were really committed to continuing Judaism, to raising Jews and having a Jewish home, then they would become Jewish. And if they're not, you know, that's their right. But you can't say, well, now we're going to have a wonderful Jewish family as a result of it. That's a very hard thing to say, notwithstanding the fact that you may have one in a thousand who has actually succeeded in doing so. But going back towards where we are here, that's my answer regarding the question of what if they're not idolaters. So Rambam quotes Ezra and says that it is a biblical prohibition in a case of marriage, in a marriage type of a framework. Interestingly, the Tur, Rabbeinu Yaakov ben Asher, author of A Major Code of Jewish Law in source number 4, rules that it's rabbinic. He rules against Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, and he says that it's rabbinic. There is one famous halachic work written by somebody by the name of the Maharam Shik, who says that can't possibly be what the Torah meant. Didn't he know about Pinchas? How in the world can he possibly? He says that's not what the Torah meant. There must be some other way to read his words. Nonetheless, it seems very clear. When he says Kuthite here, it just means non-Jew. He's dealing with the church's censors, and therefore it's better for him to say Kuthite, because they go, oh, we're not Kuthites, as you were. When it comes to the Shulchan Aruch, the Code of Jewish Law, in source number 5, the position is indeed that of Maimonides, that of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, that it is a biblical prohibition. Rabbi Isserlis, the Raman, is still in that same source, notes the dissenting view, but he's not adopting it. He just says, you know, you should know there is another point of view. So when we're dealing with this issue in Ezra, this is fundamentally what we are facing. Either a biblical prohibition of don't marry in among the nations around you, and Ezra is horrified to find out that's exactly what we're doing, or Ezra says, this is really bad that they're marrying everybody around them, either because it's against the overall themes of the Torah, or because it is causing them to worship idols. I better do something. And he institutes a rabbinic prohibition in order to get people in line. Those are your two possible versions of what happens in this narrative. Clear? Elisha,
yeah. So according to that version, then Ezra knew that they were worshiping idols? According to that?
It sounds like it in the text. Even without that version, it sounds like it in the text. Yeah, when he uses the terms, the Toavot of these nations, that I think is fairly clear that it's Avodah Zarah he's talking about. It's idolatry that he's talking about. Rabbi Ostriker and then Susan. Yeah.
The penalty is lashes. Do we just assume that the marriage is dissolved as well?
The marriage is not recognized. The marriage is not recognized by Jewish law. There's no such thing as kiddushin with someone who isn't Jewish. It's an institution that's created for Jews and Jews.
So there's no contractual relationship that has to be severed.
Correct. If they have a financial agreement between them, they better take care of it. But that's not a Jewish law issue. That's a general issue. Yeah. Susan?
Ezra would mention all the people who weren't Jewish were idolaters. He didn't need to be informed that they were. He may have needed to be informed of the intermarriage.
Oh, no, he's talking about the Jews becoming idolaters.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, that's the idolatry reference. Okay, so the report comes in. Of this intermarriage, it is unclear what the date is at the start of this chapter. Meaning, in chapter 8, it was the month of Av. Right? Remember, Ezra arrived in the month of Av, and they had their whole big celebration. And by the end of this chapter, it's going to be the 20th day of Kislev, which is 4 months after Av. Right? Av, Elul, Tishrei, Cheshvan, Kislev. We're good. So it's going to be the 20th day of Kislev. In between those dates, in between the beginning of Av, when Ezra shows up with his crew, and they wait 3 days, and then they start about bringing their offerings and so on. In between the beginning of Av and the 20th of Kislev, they're taking care of the jobs we listed at the end of chapter 8, delivering orders to the Persian officials, elevating the Beit HaMikdash, the temple, doing whatever it is that they're supposed to do. So let's take a look now at chapter 9, sentences 1 and 2, the beginning of this chapter, and see what happens when this report is brought in. So we are now on page 400 and... I don't even know what... No, we're not. That was back in Deuteronomy. Sorry. 1833. Thank you. 1833. Chapter 9, sentences 1 and 2. At the end of this, after the end of delivering all the orders and bringing the offerings and so forth, Nigshu Elai Hasarim. The officers came to me. Who are these officers? That's one of the things we need to know. The officers came to me, Lamor, with the following report. Lo nivdilu ha'am Yisrael v'kohanim v'halaviyim me'ameh ha'aratzos. The nation of Israel, the Kohanim, the Levim, have not separated from the nations of the lands. Kiso avosehem, like their toevot, which again, as I said, is a word that we usually use in the context of idolatry, not always, but generally speaking. Laknani, Hachiti, Abrizi, Ayibusi, Amoni, Hamalvi, Amitzvi, Amori, various nations, worth noting, these are not all Canaanite nations. right? Ammon and Moab are cousins. They live east of the Yarden. There's a separate prohibition against marrying Ammon and Moab. Ammonite males, Moabite males, whatever. As well as the Mitzri, the Egyptian, who we mentioned before. We said that you get three generations, then you can marry them. Kinas umi b'noseihem lahem. They took their daughters for themselves. V'libnehem, and for their sons. Notice, as we talked about last time, the emphasis on intermarriage with non-Jewish women and Jewish men. There is no reference here to the opposite. Whereas in Deuteronomy, both ways were mentioned. Here it's one way. They have mixed the progeny of the sacred, or sacred progeny, in the nations of the lands. V'yad hasarim v'hasiganim ha'yisav b'mal hazer rishona. And not only that, but the sarim and siganim, the officers and deputies, their hand was in this first. So there are a lot of questions that you could ask here, but most basically, who are the officers who are reporting this, and who are the officers who are doing it? Right? That's question number one. Are these two camps of officials? Like, why do I have these two groups going?
Princes and rulers.
Cops and robbers. Okay. We didn't have princes. I don't even know what they're talking about.
Yehuda
HaNasi
is not a prince.
Yehuda HaNasi is a prince. But that's a political title that is conveyed. It's not as though it's a
royal.
You know, it's not my father is the king or my mother is the queen.
No, so like, can you be elected as prince? Like, is that elected?
Yes, Hillel HaNasi became Nasi. He was from the family of David before that, but he was chosen as Nasi.
Right.
It wasn't something that he inherited. There was something else. Someone else was asking something.
Well, it says chiefs, so it seems like the second group that's doing it are senior officers.
What do you have as a translation for the first sarim, and what do you have for the second sarim?
The chiefs has been foremost in this transcription.
Right, but how is the word sarim translated in the beginning and the end of the sentence? Okay, Gita has a very different one.
They were representatives of the heads of fathers' houses, the national leaders. Modern scholars interpret it as government officials.
Oh, okay. So we've got all sorts of different possibilities.
Our school has a footnote.
Okay.
It says, these are the ranking Jewish officials, not the foreign officers of the preceding verse or the lower echelon functionaries of the next verse.
I'm confused by all that, but okay. I heard a lot of different terms. Yes. Entirely possible. But we're going to see something fascinating in that, I expect, this week or next week. That will raise this question. But I have another question. None of them have ever met any Prezi. The Prezi, they're one of the seven nations when we entered the land, ages before this. Right? You'd have to go back 1,000 years plus to find a Prezi. What are you talking about when you say they married Prezi? Right? That was our list. Kanani, Chiti, Prezi, Yavusi? The Yavusi? What Yavusi? I know that. The ones who lived in Yerushalayim before King David came along.
Wasn't it just the other capital?
Maybe.
These are the other, etc.
This doesn't strike you as strange.
No.
Oh, good.
This strikes me strange.
So, first of all, going back to what Malka just said, I think it's very important. I think the fact that it mentions them highlights that what we're talking about is the idolatry issue. The idolatry of the land was associated with those original nations of the land. The Baal was the Baal of the Kanani, the Prezi, and so on. And I think that's what's being emphasized by using those names. It's the idolatry that they are pursuing.
It's the idolaters.
Yes. It's the idolaters next door. But let's talk a little bit more about this. I don't want to conclude this week without having done two psukim, without having done two verses. We did learn things. True. So first of all, the language here I think really does place the marriages as having happened in this land. There's really no excuse to talk about the Prezi and the Amori if the marriages happened in Babylon. It just doesn't make any sense. in Babylon, Assyria, Persia. But I think that's a really important point. In other words, it's not just, okay, historically, this is when the marriages took place. You're Ezra, okay? You arrive in the land with your cadre of people, especially within the view, which we quoted from the Talmud, that Ezra was involved in filtering out all the different lineages, even in the first group that arrived, right? We talked about how we identified Kohen, Levi, Yisrael, Mamzer, Geri, Harime, Nesina, right? We listed all these different identifications of the different groups who entered the land. Can you imagine? He shows up and someone says, yeah, we took that whole puzzle that you did, we just threw it up in the air, and now the pieces are all jumbled again. I mean, I'm trivializing it by using that as an example. He thinks he's leading a righteous nation to construct the second temple and bring back the glory days. And he finds out that the saints and scholars he thinks he's leading are married to Canaanite whatever women, whatever nation it is, right, Shomronim, and are worshipping idols.
So this happened with the first group, the ones...
That's the way I would look at it, because his other group hasn't had time yet. They are at the maximum 4 months in. I mean, I understand they didn't date like for years in those days, but still. Yeah.
Does that mean that everybody who left Babylon was in a non-intermarried
marriage? No. Not necessarily. First of all, we had some who weren't halakhically Jewish from those who came.
That's right.
You had the servants of Solomon or whatever.
But there you go. So you started a problem on the way.
Maybe. Sorry.
They're not intermarried.
What do you mean? Who's not intermarried?
The people. Who
they aren't when they leave Babylon.
Right.
But Ezra's coming here a couple of decades later to find out that things didn't work out as planned. I think that's a very important point. I don't think this is a minor point. And, by the way, the officials are the first in line.
Yeah. What do we know about numbers? How many people are we talking about? Many? Tens of thousands?
The first group that... Oh, you mean that? That's actually a very important question for the end of this chapter.
Because you're going to end up with no chins if you all marry your first cousins. If it's a small
So what actually is going to happen is we're going to list all of the couples who separate. Because of this, we're going to identify who among the Jews separates from their non-Jewish wife. And the question is going to be, is that everybody? Or is that these are the ones who separated and the others remained intermarried? We'll see this question. The number that separate is a relatively small number, 100 and something, if I remember correctly, and 50 or so.
It's a very small group we're talking about.
I don't know.
Are you able to buy a bill if you're only marrying another, whatever you want to call them, Jews at this point?
Well,
I
understand what you're saying. Well, let's take a look, because I have so much to see here, and I want us to actually see it. Three different theories for how it was that they ended up doing this. The first theory is the most obvious, which is this is simply revisiting the same problem from the period of the Shoftim, of the judges. When we came in under Yahushua, we spent 28 years being led by Joshua, and everything was good. Then you start the period of the judges, and it's a disaster. We went native, we became like the nations around us, and all sorts of problems ensued. And so the simple approach would be, they were good when they started, and then things went bad. That would be one approach. Dat Mikra offers another interesting approach in Professor Elitzur's commentary. He writes, Mordechai Zeher Kavod is the one on Ezra. Take a look at source number 6. He says, it was simply a miscommunication. Sarei Yisrael lo chashvu kein. Ezra thought that the biblical verse applies to all non-Jews. The officers of Israel didn't think so. They thought it's just the ones who are mentioned in the Torah who are off limits. It was just a simple misunderstanding. This is called dumb kavzchus, judging them favorably. We're going to see at the end of the chapter, at the end of the next chapter actually, they're going to bring an offering to atone for their mistake. But we've already discussed the idea that offerings generally are brought only for accidental sin. So doesn't that show that Ezra viewed them as simply mistaken? So they misunderstood. Okay, that's another approach. I'm not sure how you resolve the idolatry piece of it, but that's a second approach. The third approach I thought was just absolutely fascinating. I came across this by accident some months back. I don't remember, it was a year ago. But when I knew I was going to be teaching Ezra, I put it in my notes and said, you got to come back to this. This goes back to the Brother Daniel case, which I'm not going to unpack at length here, but suffice it to say, it was a trigger case in the 1950s for a great debate of who is a Jew in Israel, who qualifies for the law of return, and it led to Prime Minister Ben-Gurion sending a remarkable letter to dozens of Jewish scholars of various stripes in Israel and around the world, asking them for input on key questions of Jewish identity, including the question of matrilineal descent. And the question of what do we accept for Jewish identity when somebody has embraced another faith? Can they still be considered Jewish? There's a remarkable book called Who is a Jewish Identity? Who is a Jew? Which is put together, which includes the original letters from many of those who were consulted, translated into English. Baruch Litvin put together this book. He's also known for his book, The Sanctity of the Synagogue, on Mechitza, and where he archived material on Mechitza from a great debate in the U.S. in the 1950s. So he also put this together, archiving the letters. And take a look, please, at the letter here that he quotes in source number 7. One of Prime Minister Ben-Gurion's letters went to Rabbi Yosef Kahaneman. Rabbi Yosef Kahaneman, I believe, was Rosh Yeshiva in Ponovich, if I remember correctly. He's Ponovich, yeah. Ponovich, major yeshiva that migrated from Europe to Israel. Migrated to Israel. So the question went to him among the dozens, and look at what he says as part of his response. He says, Joshua stood up and warned the people, pointing to the utter destruction which would be the result of intermarriage in our holy land. The issue came to the fore again in more poignant form during the second immigration in the days of Ezra, 70 years after the destruction of the first temple. About 40 years prior to the return of the exiles, all was still, as recorded in the prophets. Literally, no bird chirped in our land. Only a fraction of the people returned from Babylon. The majority preferred to stay behind. As yet, they had not overcome the horrors and the pain of destruction. The picture of the wasteland was ever present before their eyes. It seemed that the rescue of people and land demanded a temporary departure from halakha with respect to the heathen women and their children. You follow what he's suggesting? It was a policy decision. There were indeed among the leaders of the people men who took this point of view. As it is recorded, the hand of the princes and rulers have been first in this faithlessness. The expression, the hand of the princes, points to the fact there was a definite policy with regard to this national disgrace, presumably undertaken by the leaders, for the purpose of strengthening the people. It was a plan. It reminds me of the reform movement in the U.S., which at one point came out with a statement that you need to accept intermarriages in order to bolster the numbers of the Jewish people. So that's what he's claiming, and he wrote this before that ever happened. But he's claiming that that was the theory of these leaders. So what emerges then is that you actually have two camps in the leadership. Some who say, this is what we need to do, and others who, when Ezra lands, say to him, we have a problem. However, Ezra the scribe with his pure spirit foresaw the seed of utter destruction for the people, and so on. But that's the way that he looks at this. There are actually two groups involved, and one group says that this is a necessary step for us. So we have three different theories for why the officers would have gotten involved in this. The first theory is they went native. They assimilated and that's that. The second theory is it was a misunderstanding of the verse. They really thought the prohibition doesn't apply to these nations. The third, from then on, when they interviewed somebody for a leadership position, they asked this as one of the questions. And then the third possibility is that, no, this was a premeditated plan. They thought they were doing right. This was a need of the moment. And that was their justification. There's one more note we have to get to. We'll have to pick up with it next time from Rabbi Hildesheimer, a fascinating and very important decision that he issued in source number 8. So, God willing, we will begin there next time. Thank you very much. Thank you.